Good afternoon. I want to start this informal question and answer session with a disclaimer, or as my wife put it, a disqualifier at the outset. This is not my field. I am not armed with, quote, the objectivist answer to all of the questions that I'm going to be answering. Some of them are optional, some of them are my opinion, and some of them I have no doubt in the world are inherent in objectivism, and I'll try to point out as we go. This is sort of in the nature of a lark, not in the nature of an expert. Some people handed in questions. There's a tremendous number of questions. If I tried to give just the briefest answer to the most interesting of the questions written in, this would be 2 to 3 hours of nonstop. Now, I have made notes, and there's a lot of interesting things to say, so I want to just give you an idea of the topics and then give you the option to raise questions live. If you have a question that really interests you and that you think is more interesting than the topics that I'm about to indicate to you. These are not necessarily in the order that I'll answer them, but these are the topics on which I've taken notes and am prepared to give several minutes to each. Homosexuality, friendship in relation to love, platonic love, friendships with members of the opposite sex, a third person in a sexual relationship, fantasy in sex, faking in sex, masculinity and femininity, masturbation, pornography. Why are so many objectivists prudish? Family in the life of an objectivist. The right balance between productive activity, romance, children, and other values. Striptease, nude beaches. And now this goes on from there. You get an idea. That definitely is topics that are not, you know, just run-of-the-mill objectivist conference day. Now, let me see by a show of hands how many feel that they have questions they want to ask from the floor independent of or over and above these. What I'm going to do, I'm not completely discouraging you, but I'm going to make a dent, do 3, 4, 5 or something. And then if you think of questions or follow-ups or you change your mind, I'll try to remember to go back to you. But just remember this, and I'm not trying to intimidate you out of talking. It is literally impossible for me to cover the written ones handed in, even briefly. So every time you ask a question, you're knocking one of these out of the ballpark just by, I'll even go over 10 or 15 minutes, but it doesn't make any difference there because it's an enormously complicated subject. So you're free to do it, but do it if it's something urgent and related to sex and love, not, you know, infinity in the Vietnam War. Now, I'm going to start with what is the relationship. I don't know who wrote any of these. They're all anonymous. What is the relationship between friendship and love? I want to give you Ayn Rand's answer, which I finally agree with. But for a long, long time, I didn't. I used to think, as most people do, that human relations are on a continuum of closeness and intimacy, from strangers, acquaintances, and so on, all the way up to really good friends, and then lovers. And then it was a continuum all the way up, and love was just sort of to human relations what certainty is to cognition. It was kind of like the jackpot, but there were all degrees of probability leading up to it. Ayn Rand was horrified at that view, never agreed, but I now do. And her view is that if you put friend and lover in the same category and make it an issue of degree, you are uniting by non-essentials, because closeness with another human being is so radically different when it's the closeness of a friend and the closeness of a lover that it's basically equivocation to make that the common genus and think it's just a difference of degree. She said the difference between a friend and a lover is so radical and so crucial in your life that it's a mistake to use the one term to cover the other. A friend is a person who is a value, that you enjoy being with, that you spend time with, that you care about, and it comes, of course, in all degrees. Love, however, according to Ayn Rand, is a person who, number one, represents the sum of your top values. Number two is, as a result, irreplaceable. So that if they move away or they die, you can't find someone to take that position in your life. And number three involves, as a consequence of these, a desperate need for a sexual connection. If you know her view on the role of values and the role of sex, you can see why she would be outraged at the idea that her husband was her friend. She always said, he is not my friend, he matters to me. And but, you know, she meant by friend, in this sentence, she thought it was necessary to give the proper importance to love and romance in your life, that you not adulterate terms and make it just a degree of something else. It was a unique, sui generis, absolute value that was completely cut off from ordinary relations. Now, this leads right into the next question. Can platonic love between opposite sexes exist? I would say no, if the context would be appropriate to sex. I would say platonic love necessarily leads in good people to sex unless the context makes it impossible. For instance, you could say that Francisco and Dagny at the end of Atlas Shrugged have a relation of platonic love. That is, they've cut off a sexual connection. She's found gold. He still wants her. He's certainly in love with her, but there's no physical expression. If you call that platonic love, but that's a special circumstance, obviously. She's chosen somebody else after having an affair with him. The same thing might be true if she hadn't had an affair with him, but he had just met her and fallen in love, but couldn't give it expression. Or there's a lot of cases of things that approach love. A high school kid's crush on a teacher, which is very close to love in many ways, painful, intense, and violent, but has no sexual outlet or expression. Or if you're in love with someone and they happen to be crippled or otherwise unavailable because of physical problems. But if you leave aside special cases like that, in the ordinary context, something that would be dignified by the name love as opposed to friendship, it follows from what I said before, inevitably should lead to sex if there's no repression involved. And therefore, if you don't want it to lead to sex, you shouldn't have that kind of relationship, which leads to the next question. Is it wrong to have friendships? And then they go on to say, by friendship, I mean a relation in which you habitually go out to eat, etc., alone with this friend. You got that? Is it wrong to have friendships with members of the opposite sex once you are in a committed relationship? You're not necessarily married, but you're living with someone or sleeping exclusively with them, and you have a committed relationship, as a man say, and yet he's got this girl, this woman, that he wants to habitually go out to eat along with her, or the wife, the woman wants, has this male friend that she knew from before or whatever, and she likes regularly to meet him alone. Is that wrong? Well, I would say it's very ill-advised. And the first question I would ask is, why do you want to do it alone? Why? It's so important an activity to you that you want to do it habitually, and yet you don't want your husband, say, there. Now, you might say, well, because he's in Alaska, or he works 23 hours a day or whatever, so he can't come. That's very dangerous, because if this person means that much to you, and your husband is basically non-functional because he's in Alaska or whatever, you're going to end up sleeping with this plain, ordinary friend whether you want to or not, by virtue of the setup. It's back to platonic love again. And Dr. Laura, I believe, advises never to do it. And in this instance, I think she's right. Now, you know, that's okay to meet once or twice, but when it becomes a pattern, you got to know why, and you got to bring your husband, and be surprised how much less interesting you will find the old boy. All right, here's another one, and then I'll take... This one will get you. Is there a proper sexual role for a third person in a sexual relationship between two committed, rational people? In other words, a ménage à trois, at least for the night. Now, I can tell you off the bat that Ayn Rand would say no. So I have no doubt in the world what she would say. I am not entirely sure I agree with her. I essentially do, but I have a reservation. I have a reservation, and I'm just going to tell you the mental process that goes on in my mind. I end up basically agreeing with her, but I have this reservation, and I'm just saying what it is. I'm sure if she were here, she would
slap you.
She would clarify the point. All right. Now, I'm not saying what I'm about to say to be funny. What I'm about to say, she would agree with completely, so don't think that this is a joke. There is a tremendous, inestimable value in a sexual relationship, to put it negatively, to avoiding routine. In other words, to novelty, difference, experimentation. One of the deadliest things to sex is the same time, the same room, the same position, the same clothes. Okay, we started, the show is coming on, okay, let's get, etc. That is a total disaster. And the trouble is that human beings' subconscious automatizes what they do and makes it, yeah, that's to be expected. You cannot have sex like typing. You know, you just sit down and you do it and it's automatized. You need something continuously to underscore or emphasize, look what I'm doing. This is something unique and intimate and absolutely unlike anything else. This is the antithesis of routine. And human beings stand on their head for legitimately, and actually literally, for this reason, to do whatever they can different, to stress and underscore and bring out this act so that it's not just lost in the shuffle. Now, for instance, a change of location has one of its major values. You know, outdoor, indoor, this room, that room, on the desk, whichever. Different dress, sex toys, videos, and talking dirty, which I know Ayn Rand approved of. Philosophically, during sex, because it's precisely the fact that you are cultured and you speak in a literate, measured way in normal life, that when you use certain words which you don't use in polite company, they acquire a reverberation and a meaning and a stress that this is a really unique situation. This is not an activity like any other. And also, it gives you a very valuable sense that you are not just a mind. You want a role in being physical in the moment that you're having your most spiritual connection with someone. The mind-body integration requires that you super stress the physical, that you are an animal in the moment that you are most spiritually united, and that's what makes it sex, as opposed to platonic, you know, love or just a mindless coupling. And therefore, anything that can be used as a stress or as an emphasis to bring out the essence of what you're doing, I think is great. Now, the problem, and that's the only reason why I would think of a third person, certainly not as a regular adjunct. You know, it's a call up whatever her name is and say, okay, it's time again. But rarely, under certain circumstances. The problem with this is that it's theory, but as soon as I try to implement it practically, you run into real problems, because should this person be a friend or a stranger? And there's massive problems either way. If it's a friend, that's a one-shot deal, because then it ends the friendship. You know, because as Ayn Rand pointed out, you cannot demote a relationship. You can promote a relationship, but you can't demote it. That's like, you know, living with someone and then we'll just be friends. You know, you can't do it. And the same thing, once this Miss or Mr. X is in the triangle and you've had a sexual contact, you can't go back to being a friend. So it amounts to wiping out the friendship. If it's a stranger, which is more plausible, you have all the problems of a sex relationship with a stranger whom you don't know, and that can be very inhibiting if you have any tie of sex to values, which presumably you would. The best I could project, and it's in the very, very vaguest terms, is there would be some kind of congenial, really attractive stranger who descended on you and is leaving town in an hour for Mars. Maybe you could justify it. At least if somebody did it and then said, I did it, under those circumstances, my reaction would not be, oh, that's immoral, but, well, let me hear about it and see if I can adapt it, you know. So it's in that sense only that I have the faintest demur from Miss Wren. You have to decide what Peter can live with. I have a whole... Oh, I'm going to go to live ones, yeah. Yes.
I hope it's related, but I've heard people in objectivism talk about the issue of not so much menage a trois, but I love this person in this way, and I love this other person that I see in...
Yeah, multiple relationships because they each represent your values. No, I don't believe that for a minute, except in a very rare type of Enoch Arden circumstance. I can give you a couple of examples of cases where I believe that, but in 999 out of 1,000, I don't. But I'll give you examples where I do. You're in love with someone, you're married to them, the guy goes to war, a woman, the guy goes to war, you get the message he's dead. You build another relationship up with a man, you're the woman, a man. You're happy and everything, and the original guy comes back. Casablanca. You know, and so in a situation like that, it's perfectly understandable that you have the intimate knowledge of each of them, the intimate relation with each of them, and therefore the desire with each of them. Now, I do not see anything wrong in a case like that if they both know and there's no deception in going, sleeping with them for a period, the two together, until you're able to decide. But I do maintain that in the long run, if you're perceptive at all or introspective, you would have to be able to decide. And it would become intolerable to all of them involved if you couldn't, if they were rational. And because no two people are interchangeable, and even clones are just physically interchangeable, no one can be, quote, your top value in exactly the way that another person is. One of them has to be higher, given whatever your hierarchy of values is and their embodiment of it. And therefore, if you say, I really don't see any difference, you are basically condemning yourself, not on the grounds of being promiscuous, but on the grounds of having such vaguely defined values that you don't know what you want at all, which is an even worse sin. Now, I could think of another case like that. Ayn Rand, in her own life, had an affair at the time that she was married, and she justified it, presumably. She never talked about it to me, but she justified it on the grounds that she got something from her husband, which was unique, and something from her lover, which was unique. There was no deception. They both knew about it. And she was a provably unique woman who would be monstrously hard to try to find a man who had everything. And essentially, as I see it, she had a husband with a soul, and she found a lover that she thought had a mind that equaled hers, an intellect that equaled hers. And for a while, she was torn and attracted to both for profound reasons that she could not find united in one person. It was completely open between the other people involved. And at a certain point, she decided what mattered, and it came to an end. But I say, if you are not in some kind of rare circumstance like that, where you know you are this kind of super genius, or your other person been killed, or something like that, the normal 999 times out of 1,000 would never come up, because you would never get to know two people that way, that intimately. Because as you started to find the first one that really attracted you, you would get completely involved with them. And until and unless there was trouble with them, your relationship to everybody else would be like a closed book. You could nod at them and find them attractive, but you'd never get to the point where you're in love with them. If somebody who doesn't have fantastic extenuating circumstance and says, oh, I sleep around because I got all kinds of top values, is just a promiscuous equivalent of a ward here in politics. That's BS. Out and out. Is that unequivocal? All right, I want to go back to these now. That's a good question. In your book, you said that pleasures in bed must be reality-oriented and should not involve faking. What about using fantasy in sex? Are there some sexual acts that would constitute faking? Let's take that in order. Fantasy is not the same as faking. Fantasy is an aspect of imagination. And imagination is an essential human faculty of rearranging the data in the present to project what would satisfy you or what would serve a certain purpose. We could not even be purposeful beings if we couldn't fantasize. We certainly couldn't be artists if we couldn't fantasize. Fantasy is a way of concretizing your desires. It's like a mental rehearsal of figuring out in visual terms, supposedly you fantasize visually, what person, if we're speaking in a sexual context, in what circumstances, in what dress, and what do I want? This is an essential of anybody who is going to have any hope of getting what they want out of life. To fantasize. It's a problem if all you do is fantasize. But if you fantasize as a means of concretizing what you want and then make appropriate actions to gain it, that's furthermore, as you'll see when we get to the topic of masturbation, a fantasy is essential to all autoerotic activity. It's really essential to any full relationship sexually because you have to know. It's a sexual version of Socrates' know thyself, which is what fantasies tell you. Now, fantasy would be faking only in a circumstance where you pretend to yourself that the fantasy is already really real in a case where it isn't. Now, I can think of this situation. You're sleeping with Miss A, a man is, and Miss B is the one who turns him on. And he goes through the motions with Miss A while fantasizing that she is Miss B. Now that happens, you know, because you can still perform. Just the only thing is you can't call her B. That is using fantasy as faking. And that is essentially exploiting the partner because it's a complete deception. They wouldn't be there if they thought they were a stand-in for Miss B. So if you do it in that way, then I think that's definitely wrong. But if you use fantasy, and even a very fleeting fantasy of something, you can't control. Like you could be in bed with Miss A and you love her and everything, and your mind goes for a second to Miss B, and you're suddenly, it's very hard to discuss these things tactfully, you're even more... turned on, let's put it that way. Yeah, great work. That's okay. That is not cheating. But it's when you ride that fantasy, you know, say, well, boy. Are there some sexual acts that would constitute faking? Absolutely. Most people's sex life is a continuous faking. For instance, the simplest example is adultery. If it's an open adultery, then you're not faking to the extent that you're not promising loyalty. But if you're telling your partner you're loyal while you're cheating on them, or I would say sadism is faking. Now let's get it clear. I'm not talking about a slap or a pat or tying somebody's hands to the bed or, you know, middle class type domination that's perfectly okay. You know, and the same for masochism. You like being tied to the bed. That's okay. But I'm talking about really harming or demeaning the other person. You know, everything from whipping and what they call golden showers and that whole axis. That is faking. For this reason, it is resting on the assumption that the power I have over you means power in reality, means efficacy. It is the same mentality as a dictator. You're simply using sex as a means of powerlessness. It's faking in the same way. The Don Juan is a continuous faker who goes from one to the other with the idea that as he conquers her, that proves he's really good, which it doesn't, but he gets his kicks out of it, and then he rushes to the next one. And as Ayn Rand pointed out, he loves to be able to think that he's the exception, she's never done it for anybody else, and then he loses interest. All of that is a continuous faking, continuous lying through the act of sex. So it's certainly true that you can fake, but fantasy is not faking. Does the person who asked that question want to elaborate if they want any more on that? Nobody ever wants to acknowledge these questions. What, in your view, is the essence of masculinity? Do you know if Miss Rand had an explicit view on this? Now, on this one, I have no view of my own, but I know her view thoroughly. I mean, I agree with her, but I've never given it very much thought other than to say, yeah, that makes sense, what she said to me. This is not part of philosophy. I don't know what it's part of, psychology or sexology or something, but I know definitely her view on this because I've heard her state it many times. The essence of masculinity is strength. The essence of femininity, in her view, is the worship of strength. Or the essence of masculinity is being a hero. The essence of femininity is hero worship. Now, by strength, she obviously did not mean muscles, but a strong man, a la Howard Roark, John Galt, the Ayn Rand hero. And by worship, she did not mean, you know, abdication or abnegation or anything like that. It was what Dominique felt for Roark or what Dagny felt for Galt. And the best way to put it would be that scene where she described Dagny as looking at Galt and feeling that her only function was to see him. In other words, she saw... She was a non-egalitarian in regard to the sexes. She thought that obviously women have to be strong, and obviously men have to admire and value. So the difference here is exclusively within the sexual connotation. This was not a put-down of women. She always said when she said this that women have every attribute, morality, character, mathematical skills, engineering, philosophy, you name it, that men do. And the distinction is entirely in sex because of the distinction in anatomy, which she attached a great importance to, since it was there, since this is a fact of reality. And to her, man was the initiator. The male was the initiator because his function was penetration. The woman was the one being penetrated, and therefore she was inherently in a passive position. Now, already, as soon as you use these words, you have to say 1,000 times, does that mean that a feminine woman is passive in sex? No. She can be as aggressive and initiative, and you name it, it's perfectly fine, it's everything. She attached metaphysical importance to sex. In other words, it was more than important to life, it was one of the most vital fundamentals making up a life. And therefore, if in the climactic moment of an experience of that kind, the part one function was to do and the other was to be done to, that to her made an enormous metaphysical difference in the relationship. One brought the pleasure and the other received in that moment. And it's from that point of view only, and no other, that she made this distinction between masculinity and femininity. To show you, give you an idea of her character, I repeat to you without comment on this point, a conversation I had with her, and her absolutely candid reaction. Now, I realize there's 1,000 questions you could ask about this, of which 800 I would not know the answer to, so I'm not even going to open it right at this point. Because this is way outside my realm. I'm reporting to you in essence what I heard her say. She would obviously do an infinitely better job of it. But I want to just conclude my answer on this point with a story about her. I asked her once, Since you admire men so much, you have such a high opinion of men, if you had had a choice, would you have wanted to be born as a man? And she shuddered as if, oh, you know, she just flinched like that physically. And I said, why not? You know, she didn't even say no, but it was, I said, why not? She said, I'd have to love a woman. So, in other words, you get the idea that to her, the ability to love a man was such an essential embodiment of her values and of her very sense of her own identity. And the idea of a man worshiping her, believe me, I not that I tried, but I mean, from the point of view of everything I ever knew, the last thing she ever wanted was to be put on a pedestal. And in that sense, the so-called rape scene from the Fountainhead was exactly what was her own desire in her own life. She did not want to be put on a pedestal and worshipped. She wanted to be taken by a man who would say, I am the master, if you understand in what sense I'm talking about it. And to her, that was masculinity and femininity. Now, that, of course, flies in the face of everything you ever heard about, feminism and egalitarianism and all the rest of it. But you asked the question, so that's the answer. Now I'll move on to a much less controversial subject. Is masturbation sex? And did Ayn Rand ever comment on this topic? Yes, it is sex. Sex is any contact with and pleasure from the genitals. It does not say what form of contact, despite our president. And it does not say who or whether it's you yourself. If you get pleasure from scratching your back, that is not sex. But if it's the right area, it is. Now, did she ever comment on this topic? Yes, I asked her right outright. And she said that, I wish I could remember her exact words, that masturbation was the means of self-sufficiency in a world where you couldn't find the right person. It was the way that you could go through life without being deprived of sexual pleasure while looking to find the kind of partner that you want. And therefore, she was 100% in favor of it. There was never a question in the world that's entirely religious taboo to be against masturbation. And she, of course, did not have one grain of religion. Now, I'd like to point out that studies have been done that I heard her comment on, that these were studies of men, but from what I understand, the same thing is true of women, but that I don't know, that among younger married men in completely committed and happy relationships, weekly masturbation is the common practice. Even though they're completely happy, younger, because when you get to a certain age, you want to save it up. Part of the reason that they give for that is that they know exactly what sensations they want, and that they don't always get exactly those from a partner. Partly, it's practice in fantasy. They want to sharpen up what they want to fantasize, and they have to be alone to do that. And partly, it's that every man, I think, has in him somewhere the feeling he's got to be able to be completely self-sufficient if necessary. And this kind of reasserts that even in that function, I'm okay. Now, I don't know, and I'll leave it to you, whether that same last point is true of women, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. In any event, masturbation is definitely a key element. It is not only for teenagers. It's not an obligation if you don't, you know. Now I'll take a question. That's easier. Yes.
You were mentioning on your radio show that President Clinton shouldn't be impeached for what he's done.
Right.
But you also said that we should know that. What about the idea of privacy?
I do not believe that presidents are entitled to privacy. No. I believe dog catchers are. You know, lesser officials. But when you have someone who in 1700s, it's none of our business because all he did basically is raise and lower the flag. But today, when your life is totally, in every way and every department, in the hands of the arbitrary power of one man, for him to have the effrontery to say, I happen to like eating children, but it's none of your business because I only do it, off hours, is bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. You can't claim absolute power and privacy at the same time. That's my answer to that. In a reasonable world, politicians would have privacy. But if they want total power, then the least we can do in self-defense is have total ability to expose everything. And if they don't want to risk it, don't run. You know, who needs you? That's my attitude. But I'm not exactly sympathetic to politicians. Does that answer you? Yes.
Is that total power because of the fact that he's a power luster, or just because of the nature of the presidency as such?
Because only a power luster would go after the presidency today, with the possible exception of Ronald Reagan, who I don't think knew why he went after.
I mean, so you don't think it's conceivable that there's a rational guy who will go after the...
I don't think a rational person could make it through the first primary. He'd be wiped out in New Hampshire. Now, this is not sex, no. Go ahead, yeah. No, I don't want to do politics, no.
You said today. I thought that was very important.
Today, yes.
Today, not in 1776.
I already said that. Yeah, all right. All right. There are so many gratuitous sex scenes in movies now. Pornography, it seems, is becoming accepted by our culture. Now, there's a later question on pornography. Did I answer that already? And I can't even find it. So, isn't that funny? It was right here, and it's gone. But it's the next question. I missed it. It's the question before this one, so let me go back to that one. I picked up at the wrong point. Is the enjoyment of pornography immoral? Or is there a context in which pornography can be useful to a rational man or woman? I do not think the enjoyment of pornography is necessarily immoral. It comes under the category of something to break the routine, something to heighten the reality of what you're doing, to emphasize and underscore. I think it's best used, or at least one excellent use of it, is by a couple, a committed couple, a married couple, as something provocative. I'm assuming that we're talking about pornography that has some kind of standards. I mean, the content could eliminate vast amounts of pornography if it's got acts in it, which are inherently disgusting. They don't become better by being filmed. So if there's anything that's debasing and so on, we leave that out. And the same is true for pornography that features fat, ugly, dirty people. If you're going to be in a film or whatever, or expose yourself in any context, you have a moral responsibility to have a good body. Otherwise, it's immoral. It's a desecration of the human body if you are fat and disgusting to appear in the nude in public. But taking that for granted, it's some kind of, it's hard to say tasteful pornography, but it's attractive people in some sense doing things that are within the pale. It's perfectly legitimate. I wouldn't say as a daily diet, But to add spice-like sex toys, etc., for a couple to use that as a sexual enhancer. It's also essential very often in autoerotic activities because it replaces fantasy. It's like a visual form of fantasy. That's a canned fantasy of somebody else that you're provided with, and you can say, well, this is the part that turns me on and this doesn't, etc. So there are some uses of it. I do not think that the incredibly widespread use of it today is a good thing, because that takes me right to the very next question now that I read. There are so many gratuitous sex scenes in movies now. It seems like pornography is becoming accepted by our culture. What do you think? Now, I agree with the intent of this question. As it stands in America today, I think we are very, very much in the position of ancient Rome or of the Weimar Republic in the last years before Hitler, which is the complete breakdown of morality and the open blossoming of decadence, orgies. The rise of decadence is evidenced all over, not only in pornography or sex scenes in the movies, but all the kinds of things which go on today. It's caused by the fact that religion, at least organized religion, is fading, and it's being replaced by nothing but freewheeling kind of libertarian mysticism, which is, you know, do your own thing, whatever you feel like, etc. And the official establishment has nothing to offer but skepticism. And nihilism, which means, you know, the collapse, attack and assault on all standards. And egalitarianism, which is everything is equal to everything. And it's such a pervasive anti-value atmosphere that people have no standards and therefore revert to the purely perceptual. And the only way that they can be stimulated is on the crudest level, like basically like high school kids who don't have any means of getting aroused but say, oh, did you see through the back fence? And I think it's a sign of the deterioration epistemologically of the culture even more than morally, but I don't think there should be a law against it. The movies should have to make their way in a private market, and there are still movies that don't do that and that do very well. So it just reinforces what I've always said. I do not think Hollywood is motivated by the profit motive at all. If you could show them that they could make $1 trillion on making a movie of Atlas, they wouldn't make it. And they don't care about spending hundreds of millions on surefire fiascos as long as they get invited to the right cocktail parties and get to sleep at the White House. So the whole thing is outside the realm of capitalism now. Now we get to this question. Why do you think so many objectivists have a prudish attitude towards sex? First of all, I do think that prudery towards sex is very common among objectivists, present company, of course, excepted. I asked Amy, my wife, why, and she came up with the reason that many objectivists come from a religious background and they're brought up naturally, therefore, with inhibitions in regard to sex, and they just carry those over to objectivism. They still have the idea of morality. No, she also said many objectivists are strong moralists. That's the way you put it, yes. Not so much that you're brought up with religious background, but that you're they were strong moralists, and that's what attracted them here. And what objectivism did is change the content of the morality, but not their essential approach to morality. In other words, it changed the commandments. It's not you shouldn't lust after your wife's, your neighbor's wife, and you shouldn't, etc., and so on. It became you should work, and you should be self-sufficient, and you should do this. They just had another set of commandments replacing the first set of commandments, but they left out or they can't integrate the idea that the purpose is happiness, selfishness, your own enjoyment, except, and that the ones who try to integrate that go off and become whim worshippers and end up as libertarians. So this is very hard in today's culture to integrate an objective morality, and the better ones who can't end up being like religionists who have rejected religion, but they carry on the same don't do this, do this, don't do this, and that comes out as prunery and sense. I think there's another reason, which is the tendency of objectivists, especially of male objectivist intellectuals, to be rationalists. Because when they're rationalists, they are like Platonists. They live in another world of floating abstractions. And they, you know, infer from this to this to this. And when you're in that other dimension, it's a shock to come to the raw contact, you know, of genitalia and emissions and so on. And from their point of view, this is, you know, it's a little raw. So they know that sex is good, but, you know, only insofar as they can deduce it within a broad term. So I think there are reasons why objectivists are prudish that way. And I don't think that's too bad, because those who are losing the possibility of more freedom and more pleasure. On the other hand, I know, sight unseen from past experience, that this means some percentage, either of you or of those hearing the tape, are going to become libertarians, because Peikoff now said you should go out and do what you feel like doing. Which I did not say, but what the hell. Somebody had a question. Amy?
Did you want to tell them about my friend having that conversation with a bunch of guys about whether or not talking dirty was proper?
Well, just, I don't want to name it that way because it makes too clear who the person is. But there is an objectivist student that we know who took it as self-evident that the use of dirty language in sex is coarse and repellent and so on, and simply hadn't even conceived the possibility. Well, I mean, I have to tell you, I came from a small prairie town, and I moved to New York in the 50s, so I was brought up in the 40s. And there were many things beyond that, when I first came to New York, I thought were inconceivable, that I hadn't even heard of growing up. So it's not a crime if somebody, you know, doesn't know about these things. It's, the question is, are they receptive once the menu is handed out? All right. What time do we end? 4 o'clock? Because I still have millions of them here. Do you want to take another live one? You had a live one already, a live non-asker. Okay, then go ahead.
Well, absent this particular conference, over the years I've noticed that objectivism seems to attract a lot more men than women. Of the points that you've been making,
yeah,
do you think that there's any that's particularly relevant to this?
No, I think, and it sounds very sexist, that men on the whole are more intellectual than women, statistically, culturally, by upbringing and cultural expectations. Men are supposed to think and wrestle and do math and solve problems, and women as Kinderkirche, you know, like Hitler, children and church and cooking. There's an attempt to fight that, but there's still a very large element in every field of women feeling, you know, the femininity means, don't, you know, they're still brought up by many mothers. If you are that intelligent and you're that outspoken, no man is ever going to want you. And as long as you're brought up that way, you have a terrible handicap. I think that's the main factor. Every intellectual movement that's new is dominantly men, and then they bring their girlfriends with them. Sorry, but that is the culture that we live in. Actually, both sexes are held in disrepute if they think a man is supposed to be a gorilla, he's not supposed to be a quote ivory tower theoretician, and a woman is supposed to be feminine, she's not supposed to be quote an adding machine, or I guess today you'd call it a computer. thought is considered a liability to either sex today. All right, now, what is the importance? Now, listen to this question. What is the importance of family? Parenthesis. Mother, father, and siblings, and wife and children in a rational man's life. Now, if you were asked that question, what is the first thing that you would do? What is the very first thing before you did another thing? What is the importance of family? I could just as well ask, what is the importance of people? Strangers, friends, lovers, Adolf Hitler, close parenthesis, in a rational man's life. Now, family here includes indiscriminately the unchosen and the chosen, which is an absolutely fundamental distinction. You have no choice about your mother, father, and siblings. Your tie is blood and childhood experience. You can love a parent, but that is akin to friendship, as we discussed in an earlier lecture. A wife, on the other hand, so the role of them in your life is basically the past. They were the ones that you were stuck with or that brought you up or were nice to you or whatever. You're not with them anymore. So it's basically like you used to live in that country, but you left. But, you know, you meet every once in a while and so on. That is not comparable to family in the sense of your wife, who is your chosen life partner and top value, nor your child. Because your child has to be, if you have a child rationally, a major indispensable value in your life that you're prepared to subordinate even your own career to. Otherwise, you shouldn't have a child. So here again, now if the child doesn't deserve it, you give them the benefit of the doubt up to a certain age, and then that's it. But we're assuming that's not the case. When you have a child by choice, your wife and child are of the absolute top value to you, incomparably superior to siblings and parents. And that doesn't mean you should be indifferent or ungrateful or not like your brother. Get together and have dinner and all the rest of it. It's just, you know your hierarchy. You don't go to bed with your mother. You are not responsible for enabling your brother to cope with reality. I mean, the difference in these relationships is so incredible that you can't lump them under family. That's what the Republicans do. You know, I mean, but you have to think like a Republican to ask that question, if you'll forgive me. And that's bad. So many objectivists seem to decide not to have children. What should one consider when making such a decision? Now, that's not really sex, but the result. That is the only ineffable question. In other words, I don't think it can be put into words because it's not truly knowable in advance, judging by my experience. It is such a monumental thing in its positives and its negatives, that no amount of reading or study or observation, at least in my case, would equip you to even have a glimmer of what it's actually like. And not to take a lot of time on this, I would say both the positive and the negative are orders of magnitude greater than your wildest imagining. I mean, the value is so tremendous that you can never again conceive of your life without this person, nor would you want to. And the problems, the negatives, the time, the grief is so enormous that you have to continually ask yourself, how did I get into this and what for? So, I mean, and it goes, according to parents that I've talked to, it never changes. I used to ask parents, at what age does this stop? And they all answer, it never stops, it just changes its form. And one of them said, I have a child in his 50s, and still have it. There is a book that I read that didn't help at all. Called A Baby Maybe. And it's supposed to give the case for and against, but it left out all the main things. Now, Here's a question. How can you determine the right balance between, you get that? How can you determine the right balance between productive activity, romance, children, and other values? Well, I discussed this with my wife, and this is what we worked out. Productive activity, 62%. Romance, 18. Children, 16. Other values, 4. Now, obviously, there is no answer to that. No mathematical answer. There is no mathematical answer to that question. I could just give you some general observations. Number one, productive activity must remain number one in your hierarchy and in the amount of time that you give it, because that is your relation to reality. And without that, your mind and life dies or shrivels and you're wiped out for everything else. So that's got to be the dominant. Now, if you have a child, you have an obligation to that child, whether you want to spend the time or not. I do not believe in daycare. I do not believe in having a child going back to work in 2 months and turning the kid over to some British nanny, even if she doesn't strangle him. I believe if you're going to have a child, you're saddled for years, and then thereafter part-time for years in a major way with your kids. And if you don't want to do that, you shouldn't have a child. But if you've already had one, then I think you're obligated to find the time, and that has to come out of your career. Because if it comes out of your relationship with your partner, out of your romantic life, that ends the relationship. So your romantic life should be an adjunct to your productive life, but it is not a reducible adjunct. It requires a certain amount of time. You can't say, I'm so busy, I can't sleep with you this month. You know, or anything like that. So the romantic element, although it's not a lot of time, is continuous and can't be whittled away. Production should be dominant, but if you have a child, a big chunk of that in both parents has to go to the child. So that already stretches you tremendously thin. So at that point, when you talk about, and what about my other values, I just laugh. If you have a career, a love, and a child, what do you mean by other values? You may have time for a vacation. You could see another friend, you know, every 6 months. I don't know. Play billiards at 3 a.m. if you can sneak out. But basically, other values, I'm speaking for myself, this is not objectivist dogma. Other values are down the tubes. There is no time given those three even talk about other values. I'm exaggerating a little, but not a lot. I'm really not exaggerating a lot, because if you take a typical day and take, you know, the usable conscious elements, which is, say, 12, 14 hours, because then there's duties and sleeping, etc., and you're going to put 6 or 7, which I do, into work, and you're going to put something into your children, and you're going to put something into romance, where have you got time to go out and play chess? I mean, unless you do it, you know, in the cab, you know, or whatever. I read books because I waste a lot of time. I am not in my peak productive years. I feel I can take off 3 hours, and if I don't write another book, that's tough. You know, but I never did that. I never did that when I was seriously working. All right, now a big change of pace here. I want to start running through some of these. Do you have a view on striptease? Can it legitimately provide an entertainment or fantasy value? Well, now I assume you're not talking about playing strip poker with your wife. Or, you know, any game like that, I'm 100% for, because gradual and anticipation, it all helps build it up. But you're talking about hiring someone or paying someone either to come to your home, or you're going to strip club or whatever and watching. I am against that. I'm not saying it's immoral, but you asked me if I had a view on it. And this is the way I look at it. I distinguish, Jeroen reminded me of this point at lunchtime, between the nude and the naked. The nude has nothing on, and the naked has everything off. Now, a baby is born nude but has to achieve nakedness. Now, if the value of striptease is simply nudity, there's nothing on, you just see visually, the body unadorned, there's a thousand ways that you can do it without going to a strip club or inviting a stripper to your home. Sculpture is in essence that. And they give you infinitely better bodies to look at than any that you're going to see in the clubs. Photography, Playboy, magazine, all of that. The desire to admire nudity is perfectly legitimate. Needless to say, if it was a fat stripper, it's out no matter what. But the desire to admire nudity is perfectly legitimate. But in my mind, aside from your own partner, if it's just the admiration of nudity as such, there are a thousand artistic ways to do it which don't involve a live person. What the live person contributes is the element of nakedness, of a person, of she's taking all her clothes off. In other words, it's the sexual connotation. It is not the aesthetic spectacle of admiring nudity. And in a case like that, I don't see the justification, because you are pretending to yourself that this person has the spirit that goes with this body, and you're letting yourself get aroused. You could do it more honestly by projecting from a sculpture or a photograph. Now, I don't say that this is an absolute or that you are immoral if you do this, but you should ask yourself, are you doing this? Is this a form of fantasy to you? Just you want to look at these bodies, writhe and twitch and so on. I mean, if it's truly only fantasy and you have an impoverished imagination and this is what you need, I don't see anything evil about it. But I'm made uncomfortable in that context by the confusion of intention. Whether I'm looking at something from the point of view of aesthetics or from the point of view of sexuality. And if it's sexuality, I feel a lot happier watching a movie than having them wriggle in my face, which definitely seems to suggest that if I want to be that close, it's for some reason other than visual. Amy, you want to amend that?
Yeah, well, what are we talking in the room about? You said that you feel uncomfortable going to a public strip bar where you're having a sexual reaction to somebody in public with a whole bunch of strangers around.
That's yeah.
And then when you hire supposedly a stripper to come in your private home,
yeah.
Isn't that either, you know, sex with a stranger or a third person type scenario
yeah.
all over? So that was...
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying is true. And there's another point here with regard to nudity, because the next question asks about, what is your view of nude beaches? Aren't our bodies such an intimate value that we would not want to expose ourselves publicly? Now, that's the other side. Do you want to see somebody in here? Do you want to be seen? I have a view that nude beaches are optional. I tried it once and I did not like it. I didn't like it. First, a lot of the people were very unattractive. And second, I did not feel... you know, that I wanted to be looked at by absolute strangers. And it had to do with a line that Ayn Rand used in The Fountainhead about Rourke. He didn't want to show his drawings. And the shame was not that they were seen, but that they were seen indifferently. And the idea was, if I was going to be in a state without any clothes on, I want to be with someone that I think is going to appreciate what they're seeing, and not just casual strangers walking by like pearls before swine. Now, I have, in spite of, if you think I'm libertine, I have a very different attitude toward nudity in general, which is that it should not, I would never like a nudist colony, for instance, or anything like that, that it shouldn't be too much of it so that when you have it, it's an exception. I do not believe in married people who live together, walking around in the nude as a regular way of life, simply because it makes it too ordinary. It's just a routine, you know, where they sit down and have breakfast. I know whole families, kids, all of them walk around in the nude all the time in California. And I think that is making normal what should be exceptional. If you always keep a certain element of privacy, and then when the time comes, it makes a much bigger thing out of it. So I would say yes. I agree that our bodies are such an intimate value that you wouldn't want to expose them publicly or even too promiscuously privately. Make it a special occasion and then you'll enjoy it a lot more. I would make an exception for strip teases if some person had a colossal body, you know, fabulous, that you just were never going to see again, and someone that I respected said, you got to go and see what she looks like, or vice versa for the other sex. You know, I'm not that puritanical, but as a general rule, I never frequent. I think I've done this whole page now. That's one out of I don't know how many pages. Yeah.
What about the athletes in Greece?
Yeah, well, their questions. What about the athletes in Greece who all the males had mutually admired each other's bodies? They spent a great deal of time nude. Maybe I'm prudish. I mean, I'm not prepared to say that is wrong, or but you see, what you have to take into account with them is that they were not just the boys on the street, so to speak. This was a very select aristocratic class brought up with very similar values, aspirations, ideals. So it wasn't like to strangers in that way. They grew up together. And the body in Greece was a kind of symbol, an outward vessel of a kind that you would want it to be, but that is not when you talk about going to nude beaches or strip clubs in a Christian culture. Now, maybe if I had been brought up, or if I tried to project a society where they had the proper veneration for the body, so that it wasn't pearls before swine, and they were magnificent bodies, and you were brought up in that kind of context, I would have no problem. I wouldn't come out and say, well, you know, stay home and stay robed except for your wife or whatever. But I'm speaking within the context of what's available here and as it stands right now. And nor do I think, in case that's the next question in somebody's mind, well, then an objectivist nudist colony would be the perfect answer. Because I think that's beyond our ability volitionally to do in this millennium or the next. It's just a whole different culture completely. Now, what about this one? A lot of objectivists choose to live together instead of choosing marriage sanctioned by the state, etc., etc. They refer to each other, there's a long justification of this, they refer to each other as husband or wife. And wife, they're happy, and so on. My question is a state-sanctioned marriage necessary to a love relationship? Isn't a private commitment enough? Are they being dishonest in referring to themselves as husband or wife since they don't have a license? And my answer is, a private commitment enough for what? It's not enough for 100% commitment. 100% commitment requires, as marriage, a wedding, with a state license. So yes, They are being dishonest if they call themselves husband and wife without a license. A marriage is a public declaration to a society that you two are to be treated as one, and the state is properly involved in granting such a status because it is, in significant part, a legal relationship. It is the marriage contract that you sign. And the state has every right, let me say, counter to the libertarians, to decide who should be able to sign this type of contract. I do not think, for instance, if an uncle and his two 12-year-old nieces come in and say, we want to get married, the state should say, well, you know, contracts are private. Here's a marriage license. Even with consenting adults, if two women and a man come in, I think the state has a perfect justification. Or if two men come in, I don't believe in gay marriage. I believe that it's proper, since this is a special state-sanctioned relationship, that some standards be applied in the granting of this type of license. But that's a whole separate question. But why it's contractual is obvious from a thousand type of eventualities that occur once you go beyond being, you know, conjoint tenants to being husband and wife. You have made a lifetime union, theoretically, and then there's all these questions, children, and who gets custody if there's a dispute, and what happens if you die intestate, and who gets what, and even taxes, whether you file jointly, and I think the same thing would be true if it was voluntary taxes. They'd still have to know who do they take as a unit that's doing the paying. There has to be some idea when people become a unit and when they don't. That's necessary for commercial, for legal, for every other type of transaction. And from this point of view, it is not the state nosing into something that's not its business. So I think there's practical, but more than that, there is the moral. Ask yourself why you don't want to stand up and say, yes, I'm getting married. And I put it to you that whatever your answer is, it is not because you're such an individualist, you don't want to give the state this kind of power, or you don't want to recognize the power of the state. This is not a political act on your part. Believe me, whatever you say, this is because you're not 100% committed. You know, you want this if it shouldn't work out, I don't have all the grief and the lawyers and divorce and so on, this and that and the other. That if is the reason behind these questions. It's not because we really don't see that the state should be involved. Now, we got a whole bunch more questions. There's a whole bunch more on this page, too, but there's one dealing with emotions and where they come from and isn't their temperament and mood, but it's such a long question. I think what this person needs is to take a whole objectivist lecture somewhere on the source of emotions and its relation to mood and temperament, because I couldn't do it briefly. Now, I have this long question on homosexuality, but I want to just indicate it briefly. Is homosexuality immoral? And this is how the question goes on. Is it immoral? And if not, is it okay? So Amy said, well, you should say, it is moral, but it's not okay. It's not clear what the questioner is adding by the second phrase there. Now, I can't answer this at length, but I did a whole radio show on this topic, which is available for sale from Second Renaissance. By the way, for the person who asked this long question about Princess Diana, I also did a radio show on that. And you can get those tapes from Second Renaissance, so there's no reason to repeat it all. But in regard to homosexuality, since it's right on the topic of sex, I maintain that it is abnormal, but not necessarily immoral. Abnormal, but not necessarily immoral. Anything can be immoral. a homosexual relationship and a heterosexual relationship. So I'm not saying every act of coupling is moral, but I'm saying it's not necessarily immoral. But it is abnormal. And I'll just hint to you in the briefest terms why I think both. Now this is really is a subject for an entire lecture, which I am not competent to give, because this is a whole thing in the psychology of sex. But sex is not simply, quote, a response to values. You can't say, well, if somebody represents my values, naturally I have a sexual desire for them, and therefore if it's another guy or it's a woman, it's another girl, it's just the same thing. You have all kinds of responses to major values, including children and blood relatives and your mother and etc. That does not make sex appropriate. Sex is a very special kind of response to values. And one of its attributes is that it involves complete self-assertion and independence. Complete. That's one reason why incest is illegitimate. You have to be completely on your own, and that's why it's no good to have a sexual relationship with somebody you grew up with. You don't want any childhood associations in sex. You're an adult, you're on your own, you're going out in the world completely cut off from everybody else that you grew up with. Now, by that same token, sex is not an egalitarian relationship. It's not a relationship, well, I see all those great values, and they see all those great values, and we get together by committee and say, you do this, I'll do this, we'll take turns, etc. And it's not a relationship in that sense between equals. I hinted earlier at why. By the nature of the anatomical difference between men and women, there's an element of domination and submission that is central to sex. And what Ayn Rand's objection to homosexuality was that there is still unavoidably, because there always is in sex, domination and submission, but in a gay relationship, it's arbitrary. There's no anatomical basis for it. One of them plays the male role and one of them plays the female role strictly by whim. Whereas, and therefore it's a violation of sexuality. She thought that domination and submission was inherent in rational sex. So, she held that there was some kind of psychological problem from early childhood that led the better gays to be what they are. Now, there's a lot of very fine, 100% moral gay people. There's many in objectivism that I know and socialize with and I'm friendly with. And there's many outside. There's a lot of awful gays, you know, the queens and the ones who are hostile to their own masculinity. And those are, in my opinion, the equivalent of transsexuals. They want to destroy their own anatomical structure. So they are real nihilists. But we're not talking about that because there's that among straights just as there is among gays. We're talking about the typical kind of person, what usually happens if you take the male cases. The child is young and he's intellectual, he's intelligent, and he is put down by his peers for not being, you know, a brawny athlete, etc. And he starts to acquire doubts about his own masculinity. And then he finds a male friend who accepts him, and they grow intimate because to him that acceptance means he's not rejected by the male world that he admires, but about which he has doubts, and a pattern is formed very young, and by the time he becomes a teenager, he has no idea where it came from, and his desires are only in that direction. That can be 100% innocent, without any immorality or evasion or anything remotely like that. And the awful thing is that I don't know of any psychologist who can do anything about that today. Now, I think in the 22nd century, if civilization continues, they'll be able to take people and inject something in the brain or talk to them for 13 years or whatever, and they'll come out and say, oh, gee, great, and then he'll go after Marilyn Monroe. But They can't do it today. It cannot be done today, regardless of, by everything I can judge, regardless of the claims. And therefore, the way I look at gays is like this. The good ones that want, you know, a serious, non-promiscuous relationship, they are put in a position that because of errors, largely contributed to by a rotten culture, they either are going to act on their abnormal sexuality or be celibate. And I think celibacy is a fate worse than death, frankly. I don't think anybody should be sentenced to that except child abusers. And from that point of view, to me it would be immoral to say, you have abnormal desires, therefore you should give up sex. Not if it involves a consenting adult, and you're aware of what you're doing. So I have no problem being friendly with gays that live together any more than with straights, because I think I understand, at least in those cases, there are many different reasons why people are gay. There are many lousy reasons why people are straight. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't prove anything. Now, obviously, what? Okay, I just want to add politically before they change the tape. Obviously, if you're gay, you have no special rights. If people want to discriminate against you, not hire you, not house you, not let you in their restaurant, not talk to you, they have every right to boycott you. I don't think that's reasonable. But I don't own this person. If that's the way he wants to live his life, he has a political right. Therefore, I'm against all pro-gay initiatives. And so our objective is gay. Now, that is the briefest I can give as an answer. But I would suggest you hear, I had a whole radio show on this, and it's still available. Okay, I'll pause. Now, I guess our time is up, so you can go if you want, but I have a few more questions. I'm going to pause for him to change the tape. Okay, we're putting on this little addendum. I have about 5 or 6 written questions here that I'm going to try to say something on. Is there any more important, really urgent questions? I have to now dissuade you because we're already within 2 or 3 minutes of our official time, right? So, but I will take a last question or two from the floor if you have it. Yes?
Can you talk about faking earlier? What about
faking of orgasm? Well, faking of orgasm. I don't think a man can do that. So you're talking about a female? Whether a woman should ever fake an orgasm. I would not be prepared to say flat out that she never should. I certainly don't think that that is a practice that is desirable, but I can conceive of a fictional type of circumstance in which it's important in that moment that the couple have together something that, let us say, the man simply can't get to. And as an act of something or other, support, compassion, love, she is more effusive than she otherwise would be at a certain point. If you want to translate that, I can see that on a rare occasion. But I do not think as a general rule it should be done. And if it has to be done on a general rule, then it's a bad relationship, or else you should see a psychotherapist. It's basically like handing the man a helping hand in a rare circumstance, for the moment. I mean, you should tell him after it's over. Does that surprise you? All right, I'm going to take a few more written questions. What is the minimum set of philosophical congruence needed for a successful sexual relationship? No. You have to have 2 virtues out of the 7. Any 2. Well, it's easy to say abstractly, but it's very hard in practice. The minimum is that the person has to have some kind of belief in reason or intelligence so you could deal with them. And some kind of belief in individualism so you can tolerate them. If they are totally exponents of unreason, it's hopeless. And if they are total collectivists, it's hopeless. But now, within that, there is tremendous range of how important the ideas are to them that they hold, how interested they are in ideas, what really matters to them as against what they spout, and what do you mean by a successful relationship? Is this marriage? Is this a six-month affair or what? Now, let's say, talking indifferently, I have known of objectivists. I'll put this in the impersonal, in the plural, who have had reasonably successful sexual relationships with women who were religious, but not maniacally religious, but inclined to the mystical, but in the form of a sort of a hobby, a dabbling. It wasn't that big. These same women were usually definitely staunchly individualist, but that did not translate into a pro-capitalist politics, nor even an anti-capitalist politics. They didn't want the government to meddle, but they certainly wanted the welfare state. You know, standard stuff. If the woman is honest and intelligent, if you have some values in common, I think a relationship like that can last for a while and be honest and be meaningful. I don't think it has a big future unless she changes or you change and decide that ideas don't matter that much. The point is only this. You're not going to find, or rarely, unless you find somebody at a Lyceum conference, a committed objectivist on all points. But that doesn't mean that you should take the idea, well, to hell with what they think then. What counts is what then? I mean, if you say what counts is only, will they go to bed and be passionate, then you may as well go out with prostitutes. So you've got to have some criteria. And if you think, well, I'll go by values and not by ideas, what values? Is it their favorite color? What? Their favorite movie star? And why do they like him? I mean, you've got to have ideas of some kind. So the minimum I would say is some kind of reasonableness, including honesty, and some kind of individualism. And then within that, according to what you want and their interests, etc. But it's very, 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 very hard. How do two people with differing levels of desire, sexual desire, meet each other's needs without succumbing to duty or sacrifice? Well, right out front, if the differences are too big, they can't. The relationship is a mistake. I mean, if you want it every day and she wants it every 6 months, that's it. You just can't make it, and that's it. It depends what the reason are for the differences. Now, there's several kinds of reasons as to why there would be tremendous differences between people, pertaining to maybe past experience, age difference, health difference, exhaustion difference. You know, one works 15 hours and it might be the woman, and the other stays home and reads novel. And it could be a lot of different factors, and in which case then, those are adjustable within limits. And you have, the only way to do it is to deal with it. I can't quantify how much discrepancy you can cope with, but up to a point, you can cope with the discrepancy, if necessary, by having one-way sex. In other words, if worse comes to worst, one person does it to the other, even though the other is too exhausted or too sick or whatever, to do much more than, you know, help the other person along, which is a way out at times. But if that's your general form of activity, you've got a big problem. Now, I asked the person, what explains this difference? Is it something like this? And he said, no, it's completely unexplained. I said, if it's unexplained, then you've got to go into psychotherapy. Because one or the other of you has got a view, or both, view or views about sex that is making your relationship impossible. Now, the conventional case would be the woman is inhibited or repressed or frigid and has to be free. But it also works the other direction. There are a lot of men who are afraid of intimacy in any form other than sexual. And consequently, they become satyrs in real life, you know, insatiable. Because every time the wife, you know, touches them and says, "Hi, honey," their honor, and it's just more than she can accommodate. Now, the man has a problem there of having sexualized all forms of closeness. And then he's got to work his way out of it. So the problem could be either direction. But the fact that objectivism makes sex a top value does not mean that therefore, you know, it's exactly like money. Money is a great value. It doesn't mean the richest man is the best. And the same is true here. It doesn't mean the more, the better. You know, within limits, everything else being the same. But if you find that the problem, even after dealing with it, is one side has to engage in duty or sacrifice, you either change it, go to a therapist, or quit. It's a big, big problem as an ongoing thing. Now, here's a question that my wife wrote the answer to. So, in fact, I think I'll... Well, all right, I've got just a few left, and it's here. This is a written question. Men buy flowers. Men arrange mystery trips, etc. What romantic thing should a woman do for her man besides sex? And this is written by a man. So, I gave this to my wife, and I said, "I have no idea. Could you answer this question?" And this is what she wrote. I'm giving her full credit. Quote, "Cook romantic candlelight dinners. Write racy cards for any and all occasions. Why can't a woman buy a man flowers or arrange mystery trips? Surprise him with sexy lingerie or sex toys. Learn the art of sensual massage and apply it." I think that is a great start. Take it. Don't forget. Now I have three. That's the next seminar next year. Philosophic sex toys. Metaphysics, epistemology. All right. I have three more written questions, short, and that's it. If admiration and respect for someone is the source of one's sexual desire, explain Dominique's immediate attraction to Rourke the first time she sees him at the quarry when she has no idea who he is. And this is the issue of love at first sight, and it's obvious that from the face and body and posture, she projects what the soul and the character would be. She might be wrong. In this case, she wasn't. But that's exactly what happened to Ayn Rand when she met her own husband. She saw him on the streetcar and she fell in love with him before he spoke or stood, and followed him off the streetcar and finally tripped him on a movie lot to get to meet him. But she went very strongly. She had a definite type of face in Ayn Rand in her own life. And a person had that type of face, she was, you know, willing to grant a great deal of potential to them. And if they didn't, you know, the possibility of romantic interest was simply dead. Now, that can mislead you, because I've known people, the right face and everything else wrong. But in the case of Dominique, it was obvious. And you do that whenever they cast in a movie. They do it on the basis of this face and this posture and this physical person suggests this role right away, you know, and that's why casting is so crucial to a movie. Now, here's a question. Oh, that's the blank piece of paper. If a romantic couple sets a mutual goal to continually increase the pleasure that each of them experience individually from the relationship they have. What additional ways can they take action other than the following? And this is to continually increase their pleasure. What can they do besides the following? One, each partner acts selfishly. Two, each partner openly states what they want from the relationship. Three, they think of new and interesting things to enjoy together. You got me. You're after what you want. You define your values openly. You communicate them. And you continually try to invent new variations and things. You got me on that level of generality. I don't know. I mean, I was talking about this to your own. The only thing I could say is eat a good breakfast so you can live up to it. And now the last question. Wasn't Ayn Rand inconsistent? I get this question everywhere. Because she said that one interview, I'll synopsize it, that after her husband's death, I lost my top value. And nevertheless, in her writing to her career, she referred to her career as the highest value. So which was really her highest value? And the answer is it's two entirely different contexts. Her husband was her highest value in the human context. Incomparably greater than friends, as I said. But her career was her highest value in a metaphysical context in terms of what counted to her in reality, in her relationship to reality. Now, the fact, however, is that it's not just that they were the two highest in two different realms, because they were integrated in her life. She started with career as her top value, and then her husband became the top value he was, because with him, she had a celebration of all of her values, including her top value. So his value was inextricably tied to the value of her career. And the more she valued her career, the more she valued him as the expression and reward of her career. So it became one unit in her mind, and there was no inconsistency whatever. Say, which is it? And it's only context shopping that could possibly permit, and I get that all the time, people will take a sentence that she wrote in like 1938, and from an entirely different interview, like in 1971, and say, even Ayn Rand wasn't consistent. And I say to you that she was consistent. And if you pull out these, ever you find yourself matching two sentences from 40 years apart, you better ask 10 times, have I even the remotest idea of the context, or am I just a linguistic analyst pairing two propositions without any idea in the world of where they come from? And if you did that, I wouldn't be plagued with these constant letters. Ayn Rand said this, but she said that. We have four letters, because of this, which is ridiculous. So on that happy note, you want me to end on that note, but that's the last question. Well, do you want to make a last comment? What? Do you have a question? I shouldn't end on an angry note, but I can't help it. Okay, well, we'll have to close. I wish you a productive sex life. Not in the sense, I didn't mean to produce babies.